Nikki Haley, a very nice woman. She said, I'm an angry person. And they said to me, they said you were an angry person. I said, I am. I'm very angry because I hate what's happening to our country. I am angry. I'm very angry.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
WGN Chicago.
That's the Trumpster. We are going to talk to Chuck Todd. Chuck's scheduled to appear here in just a second. Chuck's ready to go. Okay, let me get to Chuck, the senior NBC political correspondent, even though he's only 24 years old and a fresh-faced youngster, just out of school, barely paying off his loans. Good morning, Chuck. How are you?
Morning, Steve.
Nice to have you on, as always. So, overnight last night, this Ted Cruz story breaks that he mishandled some FEC filings on loans he took to run for the Senate back in Texas. You know, as much as I'd like to punch out Ted Cruz, this doesn't feel like much to me. Am I missing something?
Yeah, it's not much. I think what the hit was designed to do was to get the words Goldman Sachs and connected to his name. I mean, you know, when you look at a hit, and I always look, and it's like, all right, what are they trying to get at here? Mm-hmm. You know, what he did, you know, and it was like, and why did Cruz probably do it the way he did it? They weren't wanting to advertise that they got a special deal from Goldman Sachs, because what was he doing? Railing against Wall Street, railing against that stuff. So, you know, that's what they're trying to do here, paying him a little bit that way. And, it's a ding, you know, I don't think it's anything devastating.
Isn't the net effect of most of these the amount of time it takes to respond to them versus the actual impact of what they really truly mean? In other words, it sucks up media coverage time?
I'm off a day. I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time Ted Cruz got to control his own message for the day. You know, it was sometime before Donald Trump found found love for Canada. but it's been a good week since Ted Cruz has been able to control his own message, and you know that can take a toll.
Chuck, I want to ask you. You had some interesting rhetoric yesterday when you were talking about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. I think you described this perfectly because it's really been hard to find, the drive on behalf of both. You called it a passion gap.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of expand on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's sort of you hear the phrase, you know, hearts and minds. And in general, when you're trying to win people over on something, and you see it, you know, Sanders is absolutely appealing to the progressive heart, the liberal heart, and you see it with the more idealistic crowd, and you know, those under 45 a little more idealistic than those over 45, and he's dominating among those under 45. There's a real enthusiasm. He gets bigger crowds. You know, Hillary Clinton is at this point, she's not trying the passion thing. She's trying to just simply win the minds. She's not even trying to win hearts anymore. You know, she's out with a TV ad on electability. Nothing wrong with that. But when you're trying to remind Democrats, hey, who's the one that can take these guys on, you're essentially admitting, we know you're not in love with us, but hey, why don't you make the practical decision? And for caucus, early states, you know, that's not the best place to be if you're already having to make pragmatic arguments at a time when, you know, there's a lot more passion involved.
You know, the majority of the country hasn't connected yet with this for obvious reasons. It's timing, and the majority of the country never connects till summer prior to a presidential election. Having said that, Bernie Sanders, for people that don't know him, comes off as kind of the wacky uncle that was kind of fun to see around Thanksgiving. But, you know, it's okay that you don't see him that much the rest of the year. But that's in Iowa. I mean, look, I got to give the guy credit. I had heard very little about him in all of his years in the Senate. And for somebody with almost no impact to make the splash that he's made is either reflective of the weakness of the field or that he had something to say for a long time and he finally got up and said it. And I'm not sure which of those it is.
I think it's a combination of all of it, and I think you're being too kind when you say weakness of the field. I mean, you have to say some of this is on her, and you have to ask yourself, what if her main opponent had been Joe Biden? What if her main opponent had been Elizabeth Warren? What if her main opponent? You know, you're starting to wonder if a 74-year-old semi-gadfly backbench senator can suddenly make this a race, I think it's a little more reflective of Hillary Clinton. Look, there is, pause isn't the right word, but there certainly isn't enthusiasm about her. And is it her fault? Is it her last name? Is it the year? You know, we've been trying to go through what changed in this race over the last 2 weeks that suddenly shrunk this lead? Well, you had Trump going after Bill Clinton on the personal stuff. We have had this constant sort of conversation with the country, thanks mostly to Trump, about, you know, anti-Washington, anti-establishment. And, you know, so the president of the state's talking about broken politics. Well, you throw all that together, you know, Hillary Clinton is somebody who's a veteran politician. Well, veteran politicians aren't popular right now. And then it could be there's a little bit of Clinton fatigue. I can't tell you how many anecdotal, it's hard to measure this, but how many voters you run into, Democrats you run into, you say, oh, I like Hillary Clinton, but I just don't want all the drama back. I don't want all the drama of the 90s back, you know, that sort of thing. That was a big benefit to Obama in 08. And, you know, who knows, maybe that's still sitting in the back of the mind. Again, that's a hard thing to poll. You know, we've always wondered, can you poll the idea of Clinton fatigue? But you hear it, it's anecdotal. And, you know, if it's worth a couple of points and all these things are worth a couple of points, well, then lo and behold, look at Bernie Sanders.
Well, you know, you're a sports guy, and you make an interesting point, because it almost is as if Hillary Clinton is playing to the level of their opponent. Not that the Bears ever did that this year. But, you know, take Bernie Sanders too lightly, and suddenly you wake up, and he might beat you in Iowa and New Hampshire, as opposed to somebody who would have been a threat the whole way.
It's true. You know, I also think her attacks on Sanders have just kind of fallen flat, because it doesn't take much time. I mean, right now she's trying to hit him on, you know, oh, you know, he's going to mess around with health care again. Do you really want to do that? But he's for universal health care. You know, that's some progressives are going to say, you know, that's the thing I don't like about Obamacare. You know, a lot of progressives thought it didn't go far enough. On the gun thing, yeah, I think he's vulnerable there, but she was not the face of gun control. You know, as Joe Biden said, on some of these issues, for voters, she's just as new to them as he is, if not more so. So I think it's made it so that some of the attacks by her have run a little hollow, I think.
Chuck, what can we expect to see from tonight's debate? Anything different? Anything riveting?
Anybody leaving the race in the middle of the debate?
Well, look, there's so many different weird divides going on, right? You have Trump versus Cruz. And I think this time it will actually show itself on TV. Cruz seems genuinely irritated at Trump and genuinely upset. You've got the pile-on that's taking place in the establishment lane. So Rubio Christie, I think, could get a little ugly. Jeb Rubio could get ugly. And then there's Carson, the wild card here, because he's fading fast, and desperate politicians can sometimes do things unexpected. So, you know, I think it's going to be very lively, and it could be very nasty.
Chuck Todd, Meet the Press on Sunday, and we're only a couple of weeks short of Iowa, 9 o'clock here at NBC5 in Chicago. Check your local listings around the country. Guest lineup yet, or are you still working on that?
Well, I do, but we have to wait a day before I'm popping them all out. But I can tell you this, I got both storylines represented that we just talked about, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Candidate front. And then I do have one little thing that we just did yesterday. Actually spoke to Amal Clooney. She's working Capitol Hill trying to get a United States interest in putting sanctions on a small island nation called the Maldives who've gone through some democratic repression.
Is she as fascinating as we hear? And I'm not being flip at all when I say that.
No, she is. It's real deal. You know, everything you've read. I have to say the most impressive thing was her lack of entourage and her lack of pretension.
She's got to get rid of that deadbeat husband.
Yeah, you know. What are you going to do?
What's he ever going to make of himself?
She's got to support him, dragging her out.
Exactly. Total weight. Chuck, always a pleasure. I appreciate the time.
All right, Steve.
Thanks, man. At Chuck Todd on social media everywhere. It's 7:12. Rick Pearson joins us now at RAP30, RAP30. and finest political writer in America, and host of the Sunday Spin. Who's a guest this weekend?
I have Christine Rodonio, the Illinois Senate Republican leader, will be joining us.
How is it that Mike Madigan can cancel, or I should say not convene session on time? Is that legal?
Sure. You know, at the discretion of the leaders, unless a special session is called, which is something that the governor can do. It's something that the two leaders can do. But the excuse given was that there isn't enough of a workload to convene session. I mean, you can argue that the lack of a state budget is a pretty significant workload.
And because he doesn't even show up for the meetings to discuss the state budget workload, what is the real reason that you're hearing from people as to why Madigan would do this? Just more of a negotiating tactic?
Yeah, I mean, there's no progress in these meetings. And even talking to Republican leader Rodonio, that it tends to be just kind of a recitation of talking points. And the governor and Republicans say, well, here's this. And when it comes to those union-weakening provisions, the Democrats say no.
At what point does President Cullerton have to break with Madigan and go, I've had enough of this?
Well, there's been some signs of that have occurred, but you still have to have, you know, support in the House to be able to pass anything. And if it's something that Madigan feels will weaken the Democratic majority, he's not going to go for it.
You have known of and worked around Madigan. You've spoken to him many times, many being probably a handful, because you're one of the few people he does speak to. Does it surprise you how much he's stuck to this and how long this is taking?
What surprises me, one, is that we're still at this point, that we don't have a state budget, and that we're running on this kind of court-ordered autopilot system that really is going to be devastating for the taxpayers to catch up to at some point. But that having been said, we're in 2016. We're in a critical election year. The stakes are much higher than they were even last year. And to see any progress anytime soon with the political stakes at play, I think is just very doubtful.
This has gone on a record amount of time, or are we not at the record yet?
We're certainly at the modern record. We're certainly, you know, I've been doing this for 33 years, and it's never, we've never been in this situation before, ever.
And we've on previous Thursdays, we've spoken about this many times, about how the public is not involved on the level of outrage and burning clubs in the streets and all of that, because 90 to 95% of the budget or of the state is still functioning on these emergency provisions. At what point does the bottom of that drop out?
Well, I think, one, we're seeing small signs. There's a lot of people that all of a sudden are receiving tickets or being notified that their license plate sticker is expired. And when they go to renew, they find out that it costs them an extra $20 because they're a month late. That's because the Secretary of State says it doesn't have the money to send out the traditional mail notices that it's time to get a new sticker for your car license. So there's little things like that. But at the same time, you've got much bigger things. You've got all kinds of various child care agencies that are not taking in new clients and are trying to struggle with the clients that they have. And then we get to the big issue. Now looking, we thought it would be January, but now it looks like February, the whole issue of the Chicago Public Schools. And once again, still very intense rhetoric between Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel about where's the money going to come from to avoid massive layoffs and the potential of a teacher strike.
Speaking of the teacher strike, the timing that we're hearing all the time is that the teachers are going to go out sometime in March, regardless, because it'll screw with standardized testing, and there's money that would come in over standardized testing if the teachers aren't around to administrate those standardized tests. Does this lack of a budget change that timing, if that in fact is true?
Well, I think certainly the prospect of very rapid layoffs would accelerate that strike process. But there is a legal process that also has to be done to go through the Labor Relations Board to establish that that strike take place.
Rick, what did you think of Napoleon Harris's proposal yesterday, holding a big news conference in Springfield, saying that he wants to introduce a bill that could recall anybody, kind of building off LaShawn Ford's bill of recalling Mayor Emanuel, but this could be mayors, aldermen, anybody who's elected, basically, in the state?
Well, and certainly LaShawn Ford kind of started the ball rolling, saying that his bill was more directly aimed at Rahm Emanuel, even though there's legal questions about whether it could affect him. But I think with Napoleon Harris, one thing a lot of people have talked about, if there's one thing they'd like to see in LaShawn Ford's bill, would be expanding it out to other mayors, to other elected officials, members of the legislature. One thing to keep in mind with Napoleon Harris, he's also a candidate for the United States Senate Democratic nomination. Campaign not off to a big start here. So this is kind of, I see it one way as trying to steal some of LaShawn Ford's thunder by trying to push this bill and get some publicity.
Couple of minutes more with Rick. All right, so let me just wrap up this Madigan piece of this by saying, regardless of what you think of Governor Rauner, if Governor Rauner and President Cullerton and Christine Rodonio are all sitting down at a table and the one missing element is Madigan, how is it not just about Madigan?
Well, I mean, I agree. You have to have all the players at the table, particularly given the majority that Madigan commands in the Illinois House. But that having been said, we've been through this game long enough that we know that everything that the governor has proposed has this union weakening poison pill attached to it, and that's not going to fly in the makeup of the Illinois General Assembly. So then I think it becomes incumbent upon looking at things you can do on both sides, not keep going at loggerheads over ideological issues that are not going to make it through the political climate that exists in the Illinois legislature today. It takes two to tango. And yes, Madigan's not dancing right now. He should be at the table. But that having been said, you need to start narrowing the focus on looking at things that can get done, things and changes in workers' compensation, changes perhaps involving civil liability reforms, those kinds of things, where there has been talk about this. But if the union weakening agenda is not going to make it through the Illinois General Assembly.
Right, but if I have a disagreement with you over something, I can't even present the idea you might be interested in if you don't show up for the meeting.
Correct.
So, I don't know when the public is going to connect with the fact that, and including, by the way, union members, that Mike Madigan isn't serving you. He's failing you by at least not showing up. Because, by the way, Mike Madigan shows up and Governor Rauner sticks to the same line that he is dead set against. It's not hard for Mike Madigan to get coverage. I know he hates us, Rick, but he could call you. He could call me. He could call anybody. You'd certainly get an opportunity to say exactly what went down in the meeting.
That's correct, and truly, when he has attended meetings and then spoken to the media, he sticks by his talking points as well. So we're still at the stage, truly, of people with talking points, and nobody talking about any action to get us out of this mess. And it is a growing mess. Anything that gets resolved, I mean, you know, we're poised to have the governor deliver a budget message for a budget year ahead, when we don't have a budget right now. And that the incongruity of that is colossal, because in the end, whenever we get around to fixing the budget mess for this year, it's going to require deeper cuts and higher taxes than if it had been dealt with at the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a twilight zone. Is there anything that you can think of, have heard someone suggest, have heard someone talk about, that the public can do? Because, you know, people driving to work now, people going about their business this morning, you know, maybe this is news to them, but it pisses them off, and it should. But, they'd like to know what to do about it and if they can do anything.
Well, and truly part of it, too, and I mentioned about the political ramping up, is you have both parties here in Illinois acting like it's Washington, D.C., and this winner-take-all mentality. I mean, really, what I've had folks from the Small Business Advocacy Council on my show, and it's like, you know, you don't understand the effect that this budget stalemate has on the small businesses. And, right. and everybody's so supportive of small business as job creators, those kinds of things. And if anything, along with just people, you know, just saying we're tired of this, is perhaps more activity of the small business community on really getting a budget done.
You can't have one person be able to create this kind of gridlock in the state. And until further notice, my opinion, that one person is Mike Madigan. It can't be set up that way. So if there's ever been a time where the system needs to be broken, and I mean rebroken, this is it. Clearly, the system is already broken. But this, you know, in Mike Madigan's big picture, whatever his twisted view of a winning outcome is here, in Mike Madigan's big picture, all he's doing is shining light on how he is mismanaging his incredible power in this state and the fact that he has more power than the role deserves.
Well, I mean, as I said, it takes two to tango. And yes, Madigan's been around as Speaker of the House since 1983, except for 2 years. And certainly he'll acknowledge that he deserves some of the blame that has brought us to this point. But at the same time, the governor, there's an onus on the governor as well to recognize what the political climate is. And the governor has made no secret that, you know, part of his desire is to destroy Mike Madigan's majority. And so instead of everybody just thinking this is some kind of pure conversation about governmental policy and how we move Illinois forward, there's also an overhang political element that exists on both the Republican side and the Democratic side.
Well, you know, the governor's been on the show a couple times recently and in both cases said, I absolutely have no desire to break up the unions. If he's lying, then that will be borne out. But he is asking for adjustments. He's asking for things to be done, whether they're fair or not, or whether they're union poisoning or not. The only way the public can get a true read on it is if these negotiations go on. So enough of this. Quickly, Rahm Emanuel and the governor, how bad is this relationship now? Again, Rauner was on here earlier this week, and he said he's incredibly disappointed in who the mayor's turned out to be.
Well, and here, you know, as we've talked before, with Emanuel, with the kind of crisis of confidence that exists in Chicago government, it's out of playbook 101 of the political playbook is that you kick the opponent when he's down. Emanuel has been just as vociferous in his criticism of Rauner, but the idea that Rahm Emanuel was going to be a broker for any kind of grand deal in Springfield, the more the rhetoric ratchets up, and the fact that these two were friends, and yes, there's. I said last week that, you know, they know what they're talking about. They're big boys in the room, and rhetoric's part of the game. But still, that kind of rhetoric doesn't do anything to give any people hope that we're going to get over the hurdles, the financial hurdles that the city of Chicago faces and that the state of Illinois faces. Not much confidence that's going to take place anytime soon.
But isn't there, and this is more of a general question, it takes you a little bit out of the reporter mode, but isn't there an advantage for Rahm Emanuel to stand up and say, look, I'm not picking teams here. I'm saying here's what the city of Chicago needs, and here's why this needs to get done, and not from a press conference in the middle of the city?
Well, and yeah, there is an advantage to that, but the fact is that the governor has repeatedly said that he wants to leverage the city's needs, to leverage Rahm Emanuel to support the controversial aspects of that turnaround agenda before the city will get any kind of help, before Chicago Public Schools get any kind of help. And yeah, political leveraging is always part of the game. But Emanuel says, again, you know, I'm not going to turn my backs on these people, even though he and certainly the Chicago Teachers Union, which has called for his resignation, it's not like Emanuel's has any great love from organized labor coming. But he's not willing to go to the extremes that the governor wants.
Yeah, the idealistic view of this, and I grant you, I'm way too idealistic about it, but the idealistic view of this is, do you want to be right or do you want to do the right thing? I've never lived in a time in my life where there's been more people in power who are only interested in winning the argument.
Well, and that's what I was talking about this Washington-style politics, the winner-take-all politics coming to Illinois, because, you know, you can argue about whether you viewed these certain policies, you know, as right or wrong, but there was always a statesman aspect to what ultimately occurred. And the day of statesmanship in the Illinois General Assembly is long gone, and it's truly... It's about winners. It's about winning. And it's not about really getting the all-important job done for the people of Illinois.
Rick Pearson, Sunday Morning Sunday Spin. Christine Redonio, the guest, starts at what time?
7 to 9.
And in your Chicago Tribune and at chicagotribune.com, at RAP30, R-A-P-3-0, on your social media. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you.
Preview of tonight's Republican debate in South Carolina, North Charleston specifically. Pat Brady joins me at Pat_Brady from Next Generation Strategies. Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Morning. How you doing?
Doing great. I know you just got back from Arizona. I hope that was a good trip.
Yep. Dropped the oldest off at school, and it was 70 degrees yesterday, so great trip.
All right, good. Well, I'm glad you're back. And tonight we have another Republican throwdown. Now, I mentioned this earlier when I was talking to Chuck Todd. I would love for this to be bad news for Ted Cruz. But the Wall Street Journal and New York Times story this morning that he misreported or failed to report a loan from Goldman Sachs that helped him get elected to the Senate in 2012, it just doesn't feel like a big deal to me.
Yeah, I don't think that's a big enough story. It's a little chink in his armor, but not enough. You know, the bigger problem for him, I think, is going to be, and it might start tonight, they've been going at each other, Cruz and Trump, the last 48 hours, and it'll be interesting to see if they go at each other tonight.
Christie in focus groups, and this is, gets a little deep in the weeds, but if you pay attention enough to political news, occasionally you'll see Frank Luntz and others who are focus group types get into rooms. And Iowans have seemed to respond very favorably to Chris Christie recently. Do you expect any surprises out of him?
Yeah, he's really been on kind of a roll the last couple months. He's spent a ton of time in New Hampshire, which is a perfect state for him because it's really, truly retail politics. They expect it to be in their homes. And talking to him, and I've been in a room with him a lot, and he is really, really good in a small group. So it's not surprising. That being said, my folks over there tell me that Cruz has a great organization. There are a lot of evangelicals that caucus or participate in the caucus process. So he right now looks like he's the one that'll win over there. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Christie do very well tonight because he's a great debater and do better in Iowa than expectations.
Who's next to drop out?
You know, you have to have a reason to drop out or maybe a reason to be there. Some of these guys are just there to sell books or raise money for their PACs, the Huckabees, the Santorums. So, but the dropouts will come, I think, after the New Hampshire primary where the establishment, three or four guys, see, hey, there's no path for me. Let's get together because the last thing we need is Trump or Cruz at the top of the ticket.
Is tonight one of Jeb Bush's last stands?
I think we've been hearing that for about 4 months. This is his last stand.
Is this
stand.
His last stand?
Yeah. I don't know. I think New Hampshire might be his last stand. He does have a lot of money, which can keep him going, but he hasn't had much success going after Trump. I think the big story for tonight is going to be whether the three or four guys trying the establishment, quote-unquote guys, are they going to go after Cruz? But I think they're going to go after Rubio because I think they're more fearful of Rubio right now being the establishment guy that will ultimately emerge and win. So Marco Rubio is probably going to get attacked pretty good tonight.
But if you're Bush or Christie or Kasich, there's no reason to play nice now. There's no reason. I mean, you've watched this thing degrade into the mud wrestling that it's turned into for months. So if you're going to get any noise now, regardless how qualified you are, and all three of them are dramatically more qualified than the two knuckleheads at the top. Don't they have to do something dramatic tonight?
You know, some guys, men or women, just don't do Donald Trump very well. What I mean is they don't do mean well. They don't do stupid well. Trump does it perfectly. I mean, he's a TV actor. He's playing to his TV audience. So it doesn't work for some of these guys. I think
be like when Al Gore started yelling back in the day. It just didn't sound right.
Yeah, it just didn't fit his personality. And I don't think the people that are actually serious policy people, like the guys we've just been talking about, are very good at that. Rubio is one of the best debaters I've ever seen, but I don't think he does really well as an attack dog. He's better as a policy wonk. But remember, you know, the two front runners, or particularly Trump, only 30% of the Republican Party supports him, so 70% doesn't. So I think you just got to be patient, do as well as you can in New Hampshire, and see how it shakes out.
It's tonight on, what is it, Fox News tonight? Is it Fox News?
Yeah.
Fox News.
Yeah, Fox
News.
Business. Fox Business.
Oh, it's Fox Business tonight at 8 o'clock our time. Thanks, buddy.
All right, see ya.
That's at @Pat_Brady, Next Generation Public, or Next Generation Strategies, I should say. Senator Durbin joins me now. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You normally have a tradition of having Illinois service members join you at the State of the Union. Did you do that again this year?
I did. Gary Sharp is a major who is originally from Buffalo Grove, and he is a nurse at Walter Reed Hospital. He's been in combat zones for us. Great fellow. Five kids. His daughter's in the Air Force, just deployed. I've done this, I think, for 10 or 11 years. My first guest, incidentally, was Tammy Duckworth, who was had just been shot down over a rock in a helicopter. Came in as my guest a few weeks after that terrible incident, and I met her for the first time. Now, of course, she's a member of Congress running for the Senate.
What's the state of her campaign? We haven't heard much.
Good. She's on schedule, and sadly, this is the first thing we report in terms of raising enough money to have her message known. Mm-hmm. She faces a primary. State Senator Napoleon Harris and Andrea Zopt are running against her in a primary. Her polling numbers are good, but we're not taking anything for granted.
The national campaign has to be a pretty hot topic in Washington every 4 years. You've been through a lot of these. Where does this one rank? I mean, does the inside the Beltway crowd sit around and giggle? I mean, what's the reaction to what's going on both sides?
Stunned silence on the Republican side. Stunned silence. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that Senator Cruz, could count on one hand and have plenty of room his personal friends in the United States Senate. He is a loner. Many of the Republicans have really decried his tactics, shutting down the government, right, things like that. And he's a front runner. And then there's Donald Trump, who doesn't fit any description, and is now being criticized, not just by his fellow candidates, but by leaders like Governor Nikki Haley, who in the response to the State of the Union address really made it clear that she didn't care for Trump's brand of politics. So they are stunned that the two leaders, and those two incidentally have more than half the votes of the Republican presidential primary, are two people that most of them think would have a tough time getting elected president.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by Bernie Sanders in that he's certainly not a kid. He's 74. But age isn't what it used to be, and his health seems to be fine. But everything in the Senate, everything in Congress for that matter, starts with how long you've been there. How long you've been there and the work you've done and how you've built up your reputation and the committees you sit on, and you gain authority and thump through the years. Prior to him announcing and him becoming a national figure, there wasn't a lot known by this guy. What was his Senate career like up to this?
Well, it's interesting because Bernie started off declaring he was a socialist and a democratic socialist and so forth. He served in the House for a number of years. Two things about it. First, he did take a committee assignment, an important one, the Veterans Affairs Committee, and do a fine job at it. I mean, he really is a competent person when it comes to legislating. I was really impressed. And secondly, the speeches you are hearing on the stump by Bernie Sanders, I have heard at every Democratic caucus lunch for the last X number of years. And I say that not to ridicule him, but to suggest he is completely authentic and genuine. This is what he believes. And I think people sense that. And I think that's why he's drawing the support he is.
Do you have any regret? Vice President Biden came out this week in an interview, and late last week, I guess now, saying he regrets not running. You've been a friend of his for many, 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 many years, and you know him well. Do you regret that he's not in the race?
I'm glad he's not in the race. He had just gone through a family tragedy. He and I have had several private conversations about it. And he had reached a point in his career and his life with his family. It wasn't the right thing to do. I know he looks at it and says, man, I could emerge out of this field, you know, between Sanders and Hillary Clinton and be a viable candidate, maybe even be the nominee. But it just was not the right moment.
And Senator Clinton, you're supporting Senator Clinton, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I should say. You know, you'll at least tracking the protocol, if you have too many titles, I believe the correct protocol is the last position held or the highest position held.
Would it be Secretary?
Secretary, right? Clinton.
Yeah.
Secretary Clinton you're supporting. And at this point, she continues to struggle with Bernie Sanders on her tail. When does she get some separation?
Well, you know, Iowa is an unusual place. I went there 14 times. I just reminded the president the other night, State of the Union. I said, 8 years ago, we were sitting in Iowa freezing, wondering if you even had a campaign.
Right.
And, of course, you won the Iowa caucus, and that really kicked it off. What a strange experience. I mean, I went to those Iowa caucuses, and these people are streaming in the front door of a high school, and they're saying, Republicans in the cafeteria, Democrats in the gymnasium.
Right. It's a totally different thing.
Senator, when the president left the State of the Union, you guys had a very nice conversation. I know he shakes hands and signs autographs as he leaves the chamber, but it was caught on television. You guys, he patted you on the shoulder. What did he say to you?
He said, I couldn't have done it without you. And I feel, you know, that was a very kind and generous thing for him to say. He had many more people who were more responsible. But I believed in him. I encouraged him. I was the first senator to endorse him for 14 months. I was the only senator who endorsed him. And I went to Iowa 14 times, and New Hampshire, and every place he asked me to go. I believe he's an extraordinary man. I'm glad I supported him. I think he's made a big difference in America.
Steve Scalise, the House whip, was on yesterday or the day before. And he's an eloquent guy. He can put a couple of sentences together. And he holds a position that you're familiar with from the Senate side. And there was a spending bill that got done. There was a transportation bill that got done. I don't want to click my heels too fast here. But if you take this presidential campaign out of it, is there any sort of new mood in Congress to get the people's business done?
No, and I think there's less likelihood that we will get things done. I say that with real regret. We have some chances. The president mentioned criminal justice reform, federal sentencing. That's my bill with Chuck Grassley and with John Cornyn. I have major Republican support for this bill, and we can do this together. But by and large, it's going to be an abbreviated year because of the conventions. It's going to be a year of posturing because of the presidential race. It's going to be really difficult, but I hope a handful of important things can get done. When you take a look at preparing American workers for the new economy, the tools they need, the education, the training, it really makes a difference. The student loan crisis, it is a crisis, Steve. I'm not exaggerating. There are so many young people burdened with debt they can never.
It's the next bubble, people.
It is a huge problem, and we have to deal with it and deal with it honestly. Otherwise, their lives are going to be compromised. In some cases, they're going to be ruined, and it just isn't fair.
Last question, I'll let you go. Is there anything you can do from a federal level to weigh in on the lack of a budget here and the mess that continues?
No, but I'll tell you something. It has reached the point where I was resigned, it was going to get done, and then it took longer and longer and longer. What an embarrassment for this great state. I'm so proud to represent it in Washington, but people come to me and they say, what's going on there? And I can't explain it anymore. You know, there are some things that have been set as standards we have to deal with. Labor, this and that. For goodness sakes, let's get a budget for our state. These other issues can wait for another day.
Do you understand why we can't get Mike Madigan in the room?
I don't get it. I don't know why he wasn't at the last meeting. He never spoke to me before or after as to why he wasn't there. There's plenty of opportunity now, so I hope they do sit down. There's no excuse, no alternative for the leaders sitting in the room working out their differences, painful as it may be.
Have your office call and give him my cell phone. I don't know that he has it because he doesn't call me back.
Won't do much good, Steve.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
Senator Dick Durbin in Washington. Very frank, very honest, and not pulling any punches when it comes to Madigan either.